summoning him to his duty, a task to which he had dedicated his life and to which he was now asked to surrender his marriage. "We've had some great times, haven't we?" he wanted to argue. But he could only remember times which were good rather than great, and those were long, long ago. She had always come a distant second, not consciously, but now in their new mood of truth, undeniably. He looked at Fiona through watery eyes which expressed sorrow and begged forgiveness. There was no spite, but there was fear. Marriage had been like a great sheet anchor in strong emotional seas, preventing him from being tossed about by tempestuous winds and blown in directions which were reckless and lacking in restraint. Wedlock. It had worked precisely because it had been form without substance, like the repetitive chanting of psalms that had been forced on him during his miserable school years at Ampleforth. Marriage had been a burden, but for him a necessary one, a distraction, a diversion. Self-denial, but also self-protection. And now the anchor chains were being cut. Fiona sat motionless across a table littered with toast and fragments of eggshell and bone china, the household clutter and crumbs which represented the total sum of their life together. The telephone still demanded him. Without a further word, he rose to answer it. Chapter 4. The scent of victory blinds many men. The game isn't over until the bayonet has been run in and twisted. "Come in, Tim, and close the door." Urquhart was sitting in the cabinet room, alone except for the new arrival, occupying the only chair around the coffin-shaped table which had arms. Before him was a simple leather folder and a telephone. The rest of the table stood bare. "Not exactly luxurious, is it? But I'm beginning to like it," Urquhart chuckled. Tim Stamper looked around, surprised to discover no one else present. He was, or had been until half an hour ago, when Urquhart had exchanged the commission of Chief Whip for that of Prime Minister, the other man's loyal deputy. The role of Chief Whip is mysterious, that of his deputy invisible. But together they had combined into a force of incalculable influence. Since the Whip's office is the base from where discipline within the parliamentary party is maintained, through a judicious mixture of team spirit, arm-twisting, and outright thuggery. Stamper had ideal qualities for the job. A lean, pinched face with protruding nose and dark eyes of exceptional brightness that served to give him the appearance of a ferret, and a capacity for rummaging about in the dark corners of his colleagues' private lives to uncover their personal and political weaknesses. It was a job of vulnerabilities, guarding one's own while exploiting others. He had long been Urquhart's protégé. 15 years younger, a former estate agent from Essex, it was an attraction of opposites. Urquhart was sophisticated, elegant, academic, highly polished. Stamper was none of these and wore off-the-peg suits from British home stores. Yet what they shared was perhaps more important. Ambition. An arrogance that for one was intellectual and for the other instinctive, and an understanding of power. The combination had proved stunningly effective in plotting Urquhart's path to the premiership. Stamper's turn would come. That had been the implicit promise to the younger man. Now he was here to collect. "Prime Minister." He offered a theatrical bow of respect. "Prime Minister," Stamper repeated, practicing a different intonation as if trying to sell him the freehold. He had a familiar, almost camp manner, which hid the steel beneath, and the two colleagues began to laugh in a fashion which managed to be both mocking and conspiratorial, like two burglars after a successful night out. Stamper was careful to ensure he stopped laughing first. It wouldn't do to out-mock a Prime Minister. They had shared so much over recent months, but he was aware that prime ministers have a tendency to hold back from their colleagues, even their fellow conspirators, and Urquhart didn't continue laughing for long. "Tim, I wanted to see you entirely à deux." "Probably means I'm due to get a bollocking. What have I done, anyway?" His tone was light, yet Urquhart noticed the anxious downward cast at the corner of Stamper's mouth, and discovered he was enjoying the feeling of mastery implied by his colleague's discomfort. "Sit down, Tim. Opposite me." Stamper took the chair and looked across at his old friend. The sight confirmed just how much their relationship had changed. Urquhart sat before a large oil portrait of Robert Walpole, the first modern and arguably greatest prime minister, who had watched for 2 centuries over the deliberations in this room of the mighty and mendacious, the woeful and miserably weak. Urquhart was his successor, elevated by his peers, anointed by his monarch, and now installed. The telephone beside him could summon statesmen to their fate, or command the country to war. It was a power shared with no other man in the realm. Indeed, he was no longer just a man, but for better or worse was now the stuff of history. Whether in that history he would rate a footnote or an entire chapter, only time would tell. Urquhart sensed the swirling emotions of the other man. "Different, isn't it, Tim? And we shall never be able to turn back the clock. It didn't hit me until a moment ago, not while I was at the palace, not with the media at the front door here, not even when I walked inside. It all seemed like a great theatre piece, and I'd simply been assigned one of the roles. Yet as I stepped across the threshold, every worker in Downing Street was assembled in the hallway, from the highest civil servant in the land to the cleaners and telephonists, perhaps 200 of them. They greeted me with such enthusiasm that I almost expected bouquets to be thrown. The exhilaration of applause," he sighed. "It was beginning to go to my head, until I remembered that scarcely an hour beforehand they'd gone through the same routine with my predecessor as he drove off to oblivion. That lot'll probably applaud at their own funerals." He moistened his thin lips, as was his habit when reflecting. "Then they brought me here, to the cabinet room, and left me on my own. It was completely silent, as though I'd fallen into a time capsule. Everything in order, meticulous, except for the Prime Minister's chair which had been drawn back. For me. It was only when I touched it, ran my finger across its back, realized no one was going to shout at me if I sat down, that finally it dawned on me. It isn't just another chair or another job, but the only one of its kind. You know I'm not by nature a humble man. Yet, damn it, for a moment it got to me." There was a moment of prolonged silence before his palm smacked down on the table. "But don't worry, I've recovered." Urquhart laughed that conspiratorial laugh once more, while Stamper could only manage a tight smile as he waited for the reminiscing to stop and for his fate to be pronounced. "To business, Tim. There's much to be done, and I shall want you, as always, right by my side." Stamper's smile broadened. "You're going to be my party chairman." The smile rapidly disappeared. Stamper couldn't hide his confusion and disappointment. "Don't worry, we'll find you some ministerial sinecure to get you a seat around the cabinet table, Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster or some such nonsense. But for the moment I want your mittens firmly on the party machine." Stamper's jaw was working furiously, trying to marshal his arguments. "But it's been scarcely 6 months since the last election, and a long haul before the next one. 3, maybe 4 years. Counting paper clips and sorting out squabbles amongst local constituency chairmen is scarcely my strong suit, Francis. You should know that after what we've been through together." It was an appeal to their old friendship. "Think it through, Tim. We've a parliamentary majority of 22 and a party that's been torn apart by the recent leadership battle, and we are just about to get a beating from a swine of a recession. We're no better than even in the opinion polls, and our majority won't last 3 or 4 years. We'll be shot to pieces at every by-election we face, and we've only to lose fewer than 12 seats before this government is dead. Unless, that is, you can guarantee me no by-elections, that you found some magic means of ensuring none of our esteemed colleagues would be caught canvassing in a brothel, misappropriating church funds, or simply succumbing to senility and excessive old age." Doesn't sound like a lot of fun for a party chairman, either. Tim, the next couple of years are going to be hell, and we probably don't have a sufficient majority to survive long enough for us to get through the recession. If it's painful for the party chairman, it'll be bloody agony for the Prime Minister. Stamper was silent, unconvinced, unsure what to say. His excitement and dreams of a few moments before had suddenly frayed. "Our futures can be measured almost in moments," Urquhart continued. "We'll get a small boost in popularity because of my honeymoon period, while people give me the benefit of their doubt. That will last no longer than March."
"You're very precise about that."
"Indeed I am, for in March there has to be a budget. It'll be a bastard. We let everything rip in the markets to get us through the last election campaign, and the day of judgment for that little lot is just around the corner. We borrowed off Peter to buy off Paul. Now we have to go back to pick the pockets of them both. They're not going to care for it." He paused, blinking rapidly as he ordered his thoughts. "That's not all. We'll take a beating from Brunei."
"What?"
"The sultan of that tiny oil-infested state is a great Anglophile and one of the world's most substantial holders of sterling. A loyal friend. Unfortunately, not only does he know what a mess we're in, but he's also got his own problems. So he's going to unload some of his sterling, at least 3 billion worth, sloshing around the markets like orphans in search of a home. That'll crucify the currency and stretch the recession on for probably another year. For old time's sake, he says he'll sell only as and when we suggest, so long as it's before the next budget." Stamper found difficulty in swallowing. His mouth had run dry. Urquhart began to laugh, but without the slightest hint of humour. "And there's more, Tim, there's more. To top it all, the Attorney General's office has quietly let it be known that the trial of Sir Jasper Harrod will begin immediately after Easter, which is March the 24th, to save you looking it up. What do you know of Sir Jasper?"
"Only what most people know, I guess. Self-made mega-millionaire, chairman of the country's biggest computing leasing operation, does a lot of work with government departments and local authorities, and has got himself accused of paying substantial backhanders all over the place to keep hold of his contracts. Big into charities, I seem to remember, which is why he got his K.
He got his knighthood, Tim, because he was one of the party's biggest contributors, loyally and discreetly over many years.
So what's the problem?"
"Having come to our aid whenever we asked for it, he now expects us to come equally loyally to his, to pull a few strings with the Director of Public Prosecutions, which, of course, we can't, but he refuses to understand that."
"There's more. I know there's more."
"And he insists that if the case comes to trial, he will have to reveal his substantial party donations."
"So?"
"Which were all paid in cash, delivered in suitcases."
"Oh, shit."
"Enough of it to give us all acute hemorrhoids. He not only gave to the central party, but supported the constituency election campaigns of almost every member of the cabinet."
"Don't tell me.
All spent on things which weren't reported as election expenses. In my case, everything was recorded religiously and will bear full public scrutiny. In other cases..." He arched an eyebrow. "I'm told the Trade Secretary, later this afternoon to reinforce our glorious back benches, used the money to pay off a troublesome mistress who was threatening to release certain compromising letters. It was made over to her, and Harrod still has the cancelled check." Stamper pushed his chair back from the table until it was balancing on its rear legs, as if trying to distance himself from such absurdity.
"Christ, Francis, we've got all this crap about to hit us at 100 miles an hour, and you want me to be party chairman? If it's all the same to you, I'd rather seek asylum in Libya. By Easter, you say? It'll take more than a bloody resurrection to save anybody caught in the middle of that lot."
He waved his arms forlornly, drained of energy and resistance. But Urquhart was straining forward in great earnest, tension stiffening his body.
"By Easter, precisely. Which means we have to move before then, Tim. Use the honeymoon period,
beat up the opposition, get in ahead of the recession, and get a majority which will last until all the flak has been left well behind us. Stamper's voice was breathless.
An election, you mean?
By the middle of March. Which gives us exactly 14 weeks. Only 10 weeks before I have to announce it. And in that time I want you as party chairman getting the election machine as tight as it can be. There are plans to be made, money to be raised, opponents to be embarrassed. And all without anyone having the slightest idea what we're about to spring on them. Stamper's chair rocked back with a clatter as he endeavoured to recover his wits.
Bloody party chairman.
Don't worry. It's only for 14 weeks. If all goes well, you can have the pick of any government department you want. And if not, well, neither of us will have to worry about a political job ever again. Chapter 5. A politician has no friends. This is truly appalling. Mortimer Urquhart screwed up her nose with considerable violence as she surveyed the room. It had been several days since the Collingbridges removed the last of their personal effects from the small apartment above No. 10 Downing Street, reserved for the use of prime ministers, and the sitting room now had the ambience of a 3-star hotel. It lacked any individual character. That had already been transported in the packing cases, and what was left was in good order but carried the aesthetic touch of a British Rail waiting room.
Simply revolting. It won't do, she repeated, gazing at the wallpaper, where she half expected to find the faded impressions of a row of flying china ducks.
She was momentarily distracted as she passed by a long wall mirror, surreptitiously checking the conspicuous red tint her hairdresser had applied earlier in the week as she had waited for the final leadership ballot. A celebratory highlight, the stylist had called it, but no one could any longer mistake it for a natural hue, and it had left her constantly fiddling with the colour balance on the remote control, wondering whether it was time to change the television or her hair salon.
"What extraordinary people they must have been," she muttered, brushing some imagined speck of dust from the front of her Chanel suit,
while her husband's House of Commons secretary, who was accompanying her on the tour of inspection, buried herself in her notebook. She thought she rather liked the Collingbridges. She was more definite in her views of Mortimer Urquhart, whose cold eyes gave her a predatory look, and whose constant diets to fend off the advance of cellulite around her expensively clad body seemed to leave her in a state of unremitting impatience, at least with other women, particularly those younger than herself.
"Find out how we get rid of all this and see what the budget is for refurbishment," Mrs. Urquhart snapped as she led the way briskly down the short corridor leading to the dark entrails of the apartment, fingertips tapping in rebuke the flesh beneath her chin as she walked. She gave a squawk of alarm as she passed a door on her left, behind which she discovered a tiny galley kitchen with a stainless steel sink, red and black plastic floor tiles, and no microwave. Her gloom was complete by the time she had inspected the claustrophobic dining room with the atmosphere of a locked coffin, and a view directly onto a grubby attic and roof. She was back in the sitting room, seated in one of the armchairs covered in printed roses the size of elephants' feet, and shaking her head in disappointment, when there came a knock from the entrance hall.
"Come in!" she commanded forlornly, remembering that the front door didn't even have a lock on it. For security reasons, she had been told, but more for the convenience of civil servants as they came to and fro bearing papers and dispatches, she suspected.
"And they call this home," she wailed, burying her head theatrically in her hands.
She brightened as she looked up to examine her visitor. He was in his late 30s, lean, with razor-cropped hair.
"Mrs. Urquhart, I'm Inspector Robert Insall, Special Branch," he announced in a thick London accent. "I've been in charge of your husband's protection detail during the leadership election, and now they've been mug enough to make me responsible for security here in Downing Street."
He had a grin and natural charm to which Mortimer Urquhart warmed, and a build she couldn't help but admire.
"I'm sure we shall be in safe hands, Inspector. We'll do our best. But things are going to be a bit different for you now you're here," he continued. "There are a few things I need to explain, if you've got a moment. Come and cover up some of this hideous furniture, Inspector, and tell me all about it."
Landless waved as the crowd applauded. The onlookers had no idea who sat behind the darkened glass of the Silver Spur, but it was an historic day and they wanted a share in it. The heavy metal gates guarding the entrance to Downing Street drew back in respect, and the duty policeman offered a smart salute. Landless felt good, even better when he saw the pavement opposite his destination crowded with cameras and reporters.
"Is he going to offer you a job, Ben?"
A chorus of voices sang out as he prized himself from the back seat of the car.
"Already got a job,"
he growled, showing off his well-known proprietorial glare and enjoying every minute of it. He buttoned up the jacket flapping at his sides.
"A peerage, perhaps? Seat in the House of Lords?"
"Baron Ben of Bethnal Green?"
His fleshy face sagged in disapproval.
"Sounds more like a music hall act than an honour."
There was much laughter, and Landless turned to walk through the glossy black door into the entrance hall. But he was beaten to the step by a courier bearing a huge assortment of flowers. Inside, the hallway was covered with a profusion of bouquets and baskets, all still unwrapped, with more arriving by the minute. London's florists, at least temporarily, could forget the recession. Landless was directed along the deep red carpet leading straight from the front door to the cabinet room on the other side of the narrow building, and he caught himself hurrying. He slowed his step, relishing the sensation. He couldn't remember when he had last felt so excited. He was shown directly into the cabinet room by a solicitous and spotty civil servant, who closed the door quietly behind him.
"Ben, welcome. Come in."
Urquhart waved a hand in greeting, but didn't rise. The hand indicated a chair on the other side of the table.
"Great day, Francis. Great day for us all."
Landless nodded towards Stamper, who was leaning against a radiator, hovering like a Praetorian guard, and Landless found himself resenting the other man's presence. All his previous dealings with Urquhart had been one-on-one. After all, they hadn't invited an audience as they'd laid their plans to exhaust and overwhelm the elected head of government. On those earlier occasions, Urquhart had always been the supplicant, Landless the power. Yet as he looked across the table, he couldn't help but notice that things had changed, their roles reversed. Suddenly ill at ease, he stretched out a hand to offer Urquhart congratulation, but it was a clumsy gesture. Urquhart had to put down his pen, draw back his large chair, rise and stretch, only to discover that the table was too wide, and all they could do was to brush fingers.
"Well done, Francis," Landless muttered sheepishly, and sat down. "It means a lot to me you're inviting me here on your first morning as Prime Minister, particularly the way you did. I thought I'd have to sneak in round the back by the dustbins, but I have to tell you I felt great as I passed all those cameras and TV lights. I appreciate the public's sign of confidence, Francis."
Urquhart spread his hands wide, a gesture meant to replace the words he couldn't quite find, while Stamper jumped in.
"Prime Minister," he began, with emphasis.
It was meant as a rebuke to the newspaperman's over-familiarity, but it slid off the Landless hide without making a dent.
"My apologies, but the new Chancellor will be here in 5 minutes. "Forgive me, Ben. Already I'm discovering that a Prime Minister is not a master, only a slave. Of timetables, mostly. To business, if you don't mind."
"That's how I like it."
Landless shuffled forward on his chair in expectation.
"You control the Chronicle Group and have made a takeover bid for United Newspapers, and it falls to the government to decide whether such a takeover would be in the public interest."
Urquhart was staring at his blotter as if reading from a script, rather like a judge delivering sentence. Landless didn't care for this sudden formality, so unlike their previous conversations on the matter. Urquhart's hands were spread wide again as he sought for elusive words. Finally, he clenched his fists.
"Sorry, Ben. You can't have it."
The three men turned to effigies as the words circled the room and settled like birds of prey.
"What the hell do you mean I can't bloody have it?"
The pronunciation was straight off the streets. The veneer had slipped.
"The government does not believe it would be in the national interest."
"Crap, Francis, we agreed."
The Prime Minister was careful throughout the entire leadership campaign to offer no commitments on the takeover. His public record on that is clear, Stamper interposed.
Landless ignored him, his attention rigidly on Urquhart.
We had a deal. You know it, I know it.
As I said, Ben, a Prime Minister is not always his own master. The arguments in favour of turning the bid down are irresistible. You already own more than 30% of the national press. United would give you close on 40.
My 30% supported you every step of the way, as will my 40. That was the deal.
Which still leaves just over 60 who would never forgive or forget. You see, Ben, the figures simply don't add up. Not in the national interest. Not for a new government that believes in competition, in serving the consumer rather than the big corporations.
Bullshit! We had a deal!
His huge fists crashed down on the bare table.
Ben, it's impossible. You must know that. I can't, in my first act as Prime Minister, let you carve up the British newspaper industry. It's not good business. It's not good politics. Frankly, it would make pretty awful headlines on every other front page.
But carving me up will make bloody marvellous headlines, is that it?
Landless's head was thrust forward like a charging bull, his jowls shaking with anger.
So that's why you asked me in by the front door, you bastard. They saw me coming in, and they'll see me going out. Feet first. You set up a public execution in front of the world's cameras. Fat capitalist, a sacrificial lamb. I warn you, Frankie, I'll fight you every step of the way. Everything I've got.
Which only leaves 70% of the newspapers, plus every TV and radio programme applauding a publicly spirited Prime Minister, Stamper interjected superciliously, examining his fingernails. Not afraid to turn away his closest friends if the national interest demands. Great stuff.
Landless was getting it from both sides, both barrels. His crimson face darkened still further. His whole body shook with frustration. He could find no words with which to haggle or persuade. He could neither barter nor browbeat. And he was left with nothing but the physical argument of pounding the table with clenched fists.
You miserable little sh—
Suddenly the door opened, and in walked Mortimer Urquhart in full flow.
Francis, it's impossible. Completely impossible. The apartment's appalling, the decorations are quite disgusting, and they tell me there's not enough money left in the budget.
She trailed off as she noted Landless's fists trembling 6 inches above the table.
You see, Ben, a Prime Minister is not master, even in his own house.
Spare me the sermon.
Ben, think it through. Put this one behind you. There will be other deals, other interests you will want to pursue in which I can help. It would be useful to have a friend in Downing Street.
That's what I thought when I backed you for Prime Minister. My mistake.
Landless was once again in control of himself, his hands steady, his gaze glacial and fixed upon Urquhart, only the quivering of his jowls revealing the tension within.
I'm sorry if I've interrupted, Mortimer said awkwardly. Mr. Landless was just about to leave, I think, Stamper cut in from his guard post beside the radiator. I am sorry, Mortimer repeated.
Don't worry, replied Landless, eyes still on her husband. I can't stay. I just learned of a funeral I have to attend.
Chapter 6
A monarch lives in a gilded cage. Happiness depends upon whether he spends more time looking at the depth of the gilding or the size of the bars.
I won't hear of it, David.
It was ludicrous. Mycroft was in turmoil. There were so many unformed doubts, half-fears that he could not or dared not realize, which he needed to talk through with the king for both their sakes. Yet he was reduced to snatching a few words along with mouthfuls of chlorinated water as they ploughed through the waves of the palace swimming pool. The king's only concession to the interruption in his daily exercise schedule was to switch from the crawl to the breaststroke, enabling Mycroft more easily to match his pace. It was his rigid discipline that enabled the king to maintain his excellent physical shape,
and kept all those who served him struggling to keep up. The king was a fierce defender of the forms of marriage. It came with the job, he would say, and Mycroft had felt it necessary to make the offer. "It's for the best, sir," he persisted. "I can't afford to let you become embroiled in my personal difficulties. I need some time to sort myself out. Better for all of us if I resign." "I disagree." The king spat out a mouthful of water, finally resolving to finish the conversation on dry land, and headed for the marbled poolside.
"We've been friends since university, and I'm not going to throw away the last 30 years simply because some reptilian gossip columnist might hear of your private problems. I'm surprised you should think I would consider it."
He ducked his shiny head one last time beneath the water as he reached for the steps.
"You're part of the management board of this firm, and that's how it's going to stay."
Mycroft shook his head like a dog, trying to clear his vision. It wasn't just the marriage, of course. It was all the other pressures he felt crowding in on him which made him feel so apprehensive and wretched. If he couldn't be completely honest even with himself, how could he expect the king to understand? But he had to try.
"Suddenly everything looks different. The house, the street, my friends, even I look different to myself. It's as if my marriage was a lens which gave the world a particular perspective over all these years. And now that it's gone, nothing seems quite the same. It's a little frightening." "I'm sorry, truly, about Fiona. After all, I'm godfather to your eldest. I'm involved."
The king reached for his towel.
"But damn it, women have their own extraordinary ways, and I can't profess to understand them. What I do know, David, is that it would make no sense for you to try to get through your problems on your own. To cut yourself off not only from your marriage, but also from what you have here."
He placed a hand on Mycroft's dripping shoulder. The contact was very close, his voice concerned.
"You understand me, David. You always have. I am known by the whole world, yet understood by so few. You do, you understand. I need you. I will not allow you to resign."
Mycroft stared into his friend's angular face. He found himself thinking the king's leanness made him look drawn and older than his years, particularly with his hair grown so thin. It was as if a furnace inside was burning the king up too quickly. Perhaps he cared too much. Care too much. Was it possible? Fiona had tossed Mycroft back into the pool, and he was struggling in the deep waters, unable to touch bottom. It dawned on him that he had never touched bottom, not once in his life. Far from caring too much, he realized he had never really cared at all, and the sudden understanding made him panic, want to escape before he drowned. His emotional life had been shapeless, without substance or roots, except here at the palace, which now provided his only support. The man he had once tossed fully clothed through the ice of the college fountain, and who had come up spitting bindweed and clutching a lavatory seat, was saying, in the only way a lifetime of self-control allowed, that he cared. Suddenly it mattered. Very much.
"Thank you, sir. I don't know a single marriage, royal, common, or just plain vulgar, which hasn't been through the ringer. It's so easy to think you're on your own, to forget that practically everyone you know has jumped through the same hoops."
Mycroft remembered just how many nights of their marriage he and Fiona had spent apart, and imagined what she had been up to on every one of those nights. There really had been a lot of hoops. He didn't care, not even about that. So what did he care about?
"I need you, David. I've waited all my life to be where I am today. Don't you remember the endless nights at university when we would sit either side of a bottle of college port and discuss what we would do when we had the opportunity? We, David, you and me. Now the opportunity has arrived. We can't throw it away."
He paused while a liveried footman deposited a silver tray with two mugs of herbal tea on the poolside table.
"If it's really over with Fiona, try to put it behind you. Look ahead, with me. I can't start on the most important period of my life by losing one of my oldest and most trusted friends. There's so much to do, for us both.
He began toweling himself vigorously as though determined to start that very minute.
Don't make any decisions now. Stick with it for a couple of months, and if you still feel you need a break, we'll sort it out. But trust me. Stay with me. All will be fine. I promise.
Mycroft was unconvinced. He wanted to run, but he had nowhere and no one he wanted to run to. And the thought of what he might find if he ran too far overwhelmed him. After so many years he was free, and he didn't know if he could handle freedom. He stood, water dripping from the end of his nose and through his moustache, weighing his doubts against the sovereign's certainty. He could find no sense of direction, only his sense of duty.
So, what do you feel, old friend?
Bloody cold, sir.
He managed a weak smile.
Let's go and have a shower.
Chapter 7.
Of course I have principles. I like to dust them down regularly. With a trowel. Circulate, Francis, and smile. This is supposed to be a celebration, remember?
Urquhart acknowledged his wife's instruction and began forcing his way slowly through the crowded room. He hated these occasions. It was supposed to be a party to thank those who had helped him into Downing Street, but inevitably Mortimer had intervened and turned it into another of her evenings for rubbing shoulders with anyone from the pages of the social columns she wanted to meet. The voters love a little glamour, she argued, and like any self-respecting Cahoon, she had always wanted to preside over her own court. So instead of a small gathering of colleagues, he had been thrust into a maelstrom of actresses, opera stars, editors, businessmen, and assorted socialites, and he knew his small talk couldn't last the evening. The guests had clattered through the dark December night into the narrow confines of Downing Street, where they found a large Christmas tree outside the door of Number 10, placed at Mortimer Urquhart's instructions to give TV viewers the impression that this was simply another family eagerly waiting to celebrate Christmas. Inside Number 10, the glitterati had crossed the threshold, unaware they had already been scanned by hidden devices for weapons and explosives. They handed over their cloaks and overcoats in exchange for a smile and a cloakroom ticket, and waited patiently in line on the stairs which led to the green room, where the Urquharts were receiving their guests. As they wound their way slowly up the stairs and past its walls covered in portraits of previous prime ministers, they tried not to stare too hard at the other guests or their surroundings. Staring implied you hadn't done this 100 times before. Most had little to do with politics, some were not even supporters of the government, but the enthusiasm with which they were greeted by Mortimer Urquhart left them all impressed. The atmosphere was sucking them in, making them honorary members of the team. If power were a conspiracy, they wanted to be part of it too. For 10 minutes Urquhart struggled with the confusion of guests, his eyes never resting, darting rapidly from one fixed point to another as if always on guard, or on the attack, forced to listen to the complaints of businessmen and the half-baked social prescriptions of chat show hosts. At last he reached gratefully for the arm of Tim Stamper and dragged him into a corner.
"Something on your mind, Francis?"
"I was just reflecting on how relieved Henry must be not to have to put up with all this any longer.
Is it really worth it?" "Ambition should be made of more solid stuff."
"If you must quote Shakespeare, for God's sake get it right. And I'd prefer it if you chose some other play than Julius Caesar. You'll remember they'd had him butchered well before the interval."
"I am suitably reproached. In future, in your presence, I shall quote only from Macbeth."
Urquhart smiled grimly at the cold humour, wishing he could spend the rest of the evening crossing swords with Stamper and plotting the next election. In less than a week, the polls had already placed them 3 points ahead as the voters responded to the fresh faces, the renewed sense of urgency throughout Whitehall, the public dispatch of a few of the less acceptable faces of government.
"They like the colour of the honeymoon bed linen," Stamper had reported. "Fresh, crisp, with just enough blood to show you're doing your job."
He had a style all his own, did Stamper. Across the chatter of the crowded room they could hear Mortimer Urquhart laughing. She was immersed in conversation with an Italian tenor, one of the more competent and certainly the most fashionable opera star to have arrived in London in recent years. She was persuading him through a mixture of flattery and feminine charm to give a rendition later in the evening. Mortimer was nearing 50, yet she was well preserved and carefully presented, and already the Italian was acquiescing. She rushed off to inquire whether there was a piano in Downing Street. "Ah, Dickie," Urquhart chanted, reaching out for the arm of a short, undersized man with a disproportionately large head and serious eyes, who had thrust purposefully through the crowd towards him. Dickie was the new Secretary of State for the Environment, the youngest member of the new cabinet, a marathon runner, an enthusiast, and an intervener, and he had been deeply impressed by Urquhart's admonition that he was to be the defender of the government's green credentials. His appointment had already been greeted with acclaim from all but the most militant pressure groups, yet at this moment he was looking none too happy. There were beads of moisture on his brow. Something was bothering him. "Was hoping to have a word with you, Dickie," said Urquhart, before the other had a chance to unburden himself. "What about this development site in Victoria Street? Had a chance to look into it yet? Are you going to cover it in concrete or what?" "Good heavens, no, Prime Minister. I've studied all the options carefully, and I really think it would be best if we dispense with the more extravagant options and go for something traditional, not one of these steel and glass air-conditioning units." "Will it provide the most modern office environment?" Stamper intervened. "It'll fit into the Westminster environment," Dickie continued a little uneasily. "Scarcely the same thing," the party chairman responded. "We'll get a howl of protest from the heritage groups if we tried to turn Westminster into downtown Chicago," Dickie offered defensively. "I see. Planning by pressure group," Stamper gave a cynical smile. The Environment Secretary looked flustered at the unexpected assault, but Urquhart came quickly to his rescue.
"Don't worry about Stamper, Dickie. Only a week at party headquarters and already he can't come into contact with a pressure group without raising his kneecap in greeting."
He smiled. This was considerably greater fun than being preached at by the two large female charity workers who were hovering behind Dickie waiting to pounce. He drew Dickie closer for protection.
"So what else was on your mind?"
"It's this mystery virus along the North Sea coast which has been killing off the seals. The scientific bods thought it had disappeared, but I've just had a report that seal carcasses are being washed up all around Norfolk. The virus is back. By morning there will be camera crews and news hounds crawling over the beaches with photos of dying seals splashed across the news."
Urquhart grimaced.
"News hounds?"
He hadn't heard that term used in years. Dickie was an exceptionally serious and unamusing man, exactly the right choice for dealing with environmentalists. They could bore each other for months with their mutual earnestness, as long as he kept them quiet until after March.
"Here's what you do, Dickie. By the time they reach the beaches in the morning, I want you there too, showing the government's concern, being on hand to deal with the questions of the news hounds."
From the corner of his eye he could see Stamper smirking.
"I want your face on the midday news tomorrow, alongside all those dead seals."
Stamper covered his mouth with a handkerchief to stifle the laugh, but Dickie was nodding earnestly.
"Do I have your permission to announce a government inquiry if I feel it necessary?"
"You do, indeed you do, my dear Dickie. Give them whatever you like, as long as it's not money."
"Then if I'm to be there by daybreak, I'd better make tracks immediately. Will you excuse me, Prime Minister?"
As the Environment Secretary hustled self-importantly towards the door, Stamper could control himself no longer. His shoulders shook with mirth.
"Don't mock," reproached Urquhart with an arched eyebrow. "Seals are a serious matter. They eat all the damned salmon, you know."
Both men burst into laughter, just as the two charity workers decided to draw breath and swoop. Urquhart spied their heaving bosoms and turned quickly away to find himself looking at a young woman, attractive and most elegantly presented, with large, challenging eyes. She seemed a far more interesting contest than the elderly matrons. He extended a hand.
"Good evening. I'm Frances Urquhart."
"Sally Quine." She was cool, less gushing than most guests.
"I'm delighted you could come. And your husband?"
"Beneath a ton of concrete, I earnestly hope." Now he could detect the slightly nasal accent, and he glanced discreetly but admiringly at the cut of her long Regency jacket. It was red with large cuffs, the only decoration provided by the small but ornate metal buttons which made the effect both striking and professional. The raven hair shimmered gloriously in the light of the chandeliers.
"It's a pleasure to meet you, Mrs.
Miss Quine." He was picking up her strong body language, her independence, and couldn't fail to notice the taut expression around her mouth. Something was bothering her.
"I hope you are enjoying yourself." "To be frank, not a lot. I get very irritated when men try to grope and pick me up simply because I happen to be an unattached woman."
So that was what was bothering her.
"I see. Which man?"
"Prime Minister, I'm a businesswoman. I don't get very far by being a blabbermouth."
"Well, let me guess. He sounds as if he's here without a wife. Self-important. Probably political if he feels sufficiently at ease to chance his hand in this place. Something of a charmer, perhaps?"
"The creep had so little charm, he didn't even have the decency to say please. I think that's what riled me as much as anything. He expected me to fall into his arms without even the basic courtesy of asking nicely. And I thought you English were gentlemen."
"So, without a wife here, self-important, political, lacking in manners."
Urquhart glanced around the room, still trying to avoid the stares of the matrons who were growing increasingly irritated.
"That gentleman in the loud three-piece pinstripe, perhaps?"
He indicated a fat man in early middle age who was mopping his brow with a spotted handkerchief as he perspired in the rapidly rising warmth of the crowded room. She laughed in surprise and acknowledgement.
"You know him?"
"I ought to. He's my new Minister of Housing."
"You seem to know your man well, Mr. Urquhart."
"It's my main political asset." "Then I hope you understand your women just as well, and much better than that oaf of a housing minister." "In the political rather than the biblical sense," she added as an afterthought, offering a slightly impertinent smile.
"I'm not sure I follow."
"Women. You know, 52% of the electorate. Those strange creatures who are good enough to share your beds but not your clubs, and who think your government is about as supportive and up to the mark as broken knicker elastic." In an Englishwoman, her abruptness would have been viewed as bad manners, but it was normal to afford Americans somewhat greater license. They talked, ate, dressed differently, were even different in bed, so Urquhart had been told, although he had no first-hand experience. Perhaps he should ask the housing minister.
"It's surely not that bad."
"For the last 2 months, your party has been pulling itself apart while it chose a new leader. Not one of the candidates was a woman. And according to women voters, none of the issues you discussed were of much relevance to them either, particularly to younger women. You treat them as if they were blind copies of their husbands. They don't like it, and you're losing out. Badly." Urquhart realized he was relinquishing control of this conversation. She was working him over far more effectively than anything he could have expected from the charity representatives, who had now drifted off in bitter disappointment. He tried to remember the last time he had torn apart an opinion poll and examined its entrails, but couldn't. He'd cut his political teeth in an era when instinct and ideas rather than sophologists and their computers had ruled the political scene, and his instincts had served him very well, so far. Yet this woman was making him feel dated and out of touch, and he could see a piano being wheeled into a far corner of the huge reception room.
"Miss Quine, I'd like very much to hear more of your views, but I fear I'm about to be called to other duties."
His wife was already leading the tenor by the hand towards the piano, and Urquhart knew that at any moment she would be searching for him to offer a suitable introduction.
"Would you be free at some other time, perhaps? It seems I know a great deal less about women than I thought."
"I appear to be in demand by government ministers this evening," she mused. Her jacket had fallen open to reveal an elegantly cut but simple dress beneath, secured by an oversized belt buckle, which for the first time afforded him a glimpse of her figure. She saw he had noticed and had appreciated. "I hope at least you will be able to say please."
"I'm sure I will," he smiled, as his wife beckoned him forward.
Chapter 8. Royal palaces are dangerous places in which to sleep or serve. They have far too many windows. December, the second week. The signs of festive celebration were muted this year. Mycroft, with the pressure of work easing as journalists forsook word processors for the crush of Hamley's toy counter and the karaoke bars, trudged aimlessly through the damp streets in search of he knew not what. Something, anything, to keep him out of the tomb-like silence of his house. The sales had started early, even before Christmas, yet instead of customers the shop doorways seemed full of young people with northern accents and filthy hands asking for money. Or was it simply that he'd never had time to notice them before? He made a pretense at Christmas shopping along the King's Road, but quickly became frustrated. He hadn't the slightest idea what his children might want, what they were interested in, and anyway they would be spending Christmas with their mother. Their mother, not Fiona. He noticed how easily he slipped into the lexicon of the unloved. He was staring into the window of a shop offering provocative women's lingerie, wondering if that was really what his daughter wore, when his thoughts were interrupted by a young girl who, beneath the makeup and lipstick, looked not much older than 16. It was cold and drizzling, yet the front of her plastic raincoat was unbuttoned.
"Hello, sunshine. Merry Christmas. Need anything to stick on top of your tree?"
She tugged at her raincoat, revealing an ample portion of young, pale flesh.
"Christmas sale special. Only 30 quid.
He gazed long, mentally stripping away the rest of the raincoat, discovering a woman who, beneath the plastic, imitation leather and foundation, retained all the vigour and appealing firmness of youth, with even white teeth and a smile he could almost mistake as genuine. He hadn't talked to anyone about anything except business for more than 3 days, and he knew he desperately missed companionship. Even bickering with his wife about the brand of toothpaste had been better than silence. Nothing. He needed some human contact, a touch, and he would feel no guilt, not after Fiona's performance. A chance to get back at her in some way, to be something other than a witless cuckold. He looked once again at the girl, and even as he thought of revenge, he found himself overcome with revulsion. The thought of her nakedness, her nipples, her body hair, the scratchy bits under her armpits, the very smell of her suddenly made him feel nauseous. He panicked at the embarrassment of being propositioned. What if someone saw? But more in surprise at the strength of his own feelings. He found her physically repellent. Was it simply because she was the same sex as Fiona? He found a 5-pound note in his hand, thrust it at her, and spat. "Go away! God's sake, go away!" He then panicked more, realizing that someone might have seen him give the tart money, turned and ran. She followed, calling after him, anxious not to forego the chance of any trick, particularly one who gave away free fivers. He'd run 70 yards before he realized he was still making a fool of himself out on the street, and saw a door for a drinking club. He dashed in, lungs and stomach heaving. He ignored the sardonic look of the man who took his coat and went straight to the bar, ordering himself a large whiskey. It took a while before he had recovered his breath and his composure sufficiently to look around and run the risk of catching someone's eye. The club itself was nothing more than a revamped pub with black walls, lots of mirrors, and plentiful disco lights. There was a raised dance floor at one end, but neither the lights nor jukebox were working. It was still early. There were scarcely a handful of customers who gazed distractedly at one of the plentiful television monitors on which an old Marlon Brando film was playing. The sound turned off so as not to clash with the piped Christmas music the staff had turned on for their own entertainment. There were large photos of Brando on the walls, in motorcycle leathers from one of his early films, along with posters of Presley, Jack Nicholson, and a couple of other younger film stars he didn't recognize. It was odd, different, a total contrast to the gentlemen's clubs of Pall Mall to which Mycroft was accustomed. There were no seats, This was a watering hole designed for standing and moving, not for spending all evening mooning over a half pint. He rather liked it. You entered in something of a hurry. A man, in his 30s and well-presented, a Brummie by his accent, was standing next to him. Mind if I join you? Mycroft shrugged. He was still dazed from his encounter and lacked the self-confidence to be rude and turn away a friendly voice. The stranger was casually but very neatly dressed, his stonewashed jeans immaculately pressed, as was his white shirt, sleeves rolled up narrow and high and with great care. He was obviously fit. The muscles showed prominently. You looked as if you were running from something. The whiskey was making Mycroft feel warmer. He needed to ease up a little. He laughed. A woman, actually, tried to pick me up. They were both laughing, and Mycroft noted the stranger inspecting him carefully. He didn't object. The eyes were warm, concerned, interested, and interesting. A golden shade of brown. It's usually the other way round, women running from me, he continued. Makes you sound like something of a stud. No, that's not what I meant. Mycroft bit his lip, suddenly feeling the pain and the humiliation of being alone at Christmas. My wife walked out on me, after 23 years. I'm sorry. Why should you be? You don't know her, or me. Once more the confusion flooded over him. My apologies, churlish of me. Don't worry. Shout if it helps, I don't mind. Thanks. I might just do that. He extended a hand. David. Kenny. Just remember, David, that you're not on your own. Believe me, there are thousands of people just like you. Feeling alone at Christmas when there's no need. One door closes, another opens. Think of it as a new beginning. Somebody else I know said something like that. Which must make it right. He had a broad, easy smile which had a lot of life to it, and was drinking straight from a bottle of exotic Mexican beer with a lime slice stuffed in the neck. Mycroft looked at his whiskey and wondered whether he should try something new, but decided he was probably too old to change his habits. He tried to remember how long it had been since he had tried anything or met anyone new, outside of work. What do you do, Kenny?
Cabin crew. Fly the fag BA.
And you?
Civil servant.
Sounds horribly dull.
Then my job sounds horribly glamorous, but it's not. You get bored fending off movie queens in first class. You travel a lot?
Mycroft was just about to answer when the piped strains of Jingle Bells was replaced by the heavy thumping of the jukebox. The evening was warming up. He had to bend close to hear what Kenny was saying and to be heard. Kenny had a freshly scrubbed smell with the slightest trace of aftershave. He was bawling into Mycroft's ear to make himself heard, suggesting they might find a place to eat, out of the din. Mycroft was trembling once again. It wasn't just the prospect of going back out alone into the cold streets again. Perhaps finding the tart waiting to accost him, or returning home to an empty house. It wasn't just the fact that this was the first time for years someone had been interested in him as a person, rather than as someone who was close to the king. It wasn't even that he felt warmed by Kenny's easy smile, and already felt better than he had done all week. It was the fact that, however much he tried to hide from it or explain it away, he wanted to get to know Kenny very much better. Very much better indeed. Chapter 9. His royal mind progresses by a series of afterthoughts. He treads the tightrope that stretches between the constitution and his conscience with the blinding sense of purpose of a pilchard. The two men were walking around the lake, one dressed warmly in hacking jacket and gumboots, while the other shivered inside his cashmere overcoat and struggled to prevent his hand-stitched leather shoes slipping in the damp grass. Near at hand, a domestic tractor was ploughing up a substantial section of plush lawn, marked off inside guide ropes, while beyond a pair of workmen manoeuvred saplings and young trees into holes, which further disfigured the once gracious lawn, already scarred by the tire marks of earth-moving equipment. The effect was to spread dark winter mud everywhere, and even the enthusiasm of the king couldn't persuade Urquhart that the gardens of Buckingham Palace would ever recover their former glories. The king had suggested the walk.